Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing the first half of an interview I did with the irrepressible, the one-of-a-kind, Harry Bryce, dancer, choreographer, director, and philosopher. This is a fascinating interview with a remarkable, unique, unduplicatable human being. So hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being all that you are. As a psychotherapist, I am continually reminded, over and over, day in and day out, that, unfortunately, childhood does not provide for everyone the nurturing environment that allows them to develop all of their natural talents, skills, abilities, ideas, wishes, fantasies, instincts. Unfortunately, too many childhoods are full of discouragement in one way or another. Either our family of origin doesn't like something about us or wants us to be something that we are not naturally. Sometimes siblings, friends, peers can insult us, embarrass us, tease us in ways that make us embarrassed to be who we are, reluctant to demonstrate what is natural to us. This can be done subtly. Rolling of the eyes, turning away, snickering, teasing. People think that teasing is harmless. They think that sarcasm is funny. In fact, teasing and sarcasm are cruel. People who are teased, people who are made fun of, take that very, very much to heart. And quite often the result of that is that something that feels right, that is natural, is seen by the person who has it as something ugly, something to be hidden, something to be to pretend isn't there. And the remarkable thing about childhood is that we can not only pretend it isn't there, we pretend so good that we forget that it is there. And so, unfortunately, again, so many people come out of childhood without access to those things which are the most important to them, their natural self. And this can be talents, this can be impressions, this can be ways of being in the world. I quite often make reference to, you know, the way a person laughs, or the way a person eats, or the way a person walks, or the kind of hair they have, or the color of their hair, or the color of their eyes. Maybe you live in a family and everybody in the family has blue eyes and you have brown eyes. This doesn't seem like a big deal, but you can be made to feel that you don't fit, and this idea that you don't fit lives with you, and you take that with you into the world, and then you act it out. Okay, so as a psychotherapist, it is my job to help people recognize what they have left behind and help them to recover it. And recovery is possible. It's not easy. That is the job of psychotherapy. And actually, there are other places that recovery is possible, and you're going to hear the person I've interviewed today talk, and I talk about that later. But one of the places that can happen is psychotherapy. So if you have been listening to me, if you've heard the show before, if on your own you have felt that there's something about you that you can't get at, there's something you always wanted to do but you're afraid, or you don't think you're good enough, or you whatever you tell yourself, and you really want to look at whether that it's possible to do and be that, and you want to talk to me about that, you can reach me at my website. It is thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You'll get another The Lynn Show. And I do all my work on the phone these days, so wherever you are, if you're interested in coming into therapy with me, I'm at the end of the phone line. On the website, you can also find an article that I wrote about psychotherapy on the telephone, called Psychotherapy on the Go. You can listen to me reading the first chapter of my book, and you can get access to all of my shows in podcast form, including the one I'm doing right this minute. In order to make this point about what it's like to be who you really are, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Because when you listen to them, you can hear what it is. And the interview I'm playing today, this is the first half of my interview with the extraordinary, unduplicatable Harry Bryce. He is a choreographer, a dancer, a director, an actor. He's currently directing the West Coast Black Theater Troupe production of the groundbreaking West Coast Black Theater Troupe production of The Little Shop of Horrors. Harry is an extraordinary guy, and this interview, I didn't want to cut any more of it than I had to, so I'm playing part one this week and part two next week. And I don't want to take any more time from this interview. It's so fascinating and delightful. So here, without another second, is Harry Bryce. I'm here with Harry Bryce in the West Coast Black Theater Troupe Theater.
Yes.
Okay, and I'm interviewing Harry because he is directing Bubbling Brown Sugar.
Yes.
Which is soon to be running at West Coast Black Theater Troupe.
Absolutely.
And I interview people who make their living or their life mm-hmm. with an art. Mm-hmm. And it is clear that you are making some, all, much of your living and your life.
It is my life.
With and theater, with directing.
Directing, choreography. I worked as a choreographer for many years and a dancer when I was young, and in theater I was an actor and a dancer, and then when it got into choreography and had my own dance company for years, and then went in fully into directing theater, but only after figuring out that what I was doing was theater all along, even though it was dance.
Yes.
And so the transition wasn't as painful as it could have been, but they all work together, so I have done
everything
that you can imagine in this world.
Well, I'm wanting to hear about all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I always begin by asking the same question.
Sure.
That is, can you remember, do you know, the very first moment in your life when dancing, performing, being looked at, being on stage, any of that called you, spoke to you, happened to you, attracted you, drew you?
Well, for me, I'm sure it is different for every artist because we come into that world at different times and are inspired to make a decision about the rest of our lives most of the time if you're an artist.
Okay, but I'm not asking when you made that decision, but when the very first moment that it sparked for you.
I think, yes, I can say that. For me, words were my first introduction to expression.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very personal. And I didn't realize that I was even composing poetry until I had written quite a bit of poetry.
And how old were you?
And I was maybe 7.
Uh-huh. So you just started spontaneously to write?
I started spontaneously to write, and I was writing to speak to myself.
Yes.
And it was my closest confidant.
Yes. I need to express this.
I need to, and this is the only way that I feel most secure in expressing it, because if I don't get it out, I'm going to be crazy.
Yes.
So it was my only way of handling that kind of energy.
Yes.
And
but you must have already known a lot of words, had an attraction to words themselves, no?
Well, yes, because I grew up in a household of voracious readers.
Ah, yes.
My father in particular. And so speaking was important in my house.
Yes.
Being correct and articulate was important in my house. And having an interesting vocabulary. It was not, my father didn't care as long as it was interesting.
Wow.
And you were using words that someone hadn't heard and could say, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that we were all engaged.
Yes. And that's a way to, I don't mean this, I want to say curry favor,
mm-hmm.
that you knew that this would be, that this would please him.
Oh, I did, and I was very interested in
mm-hmm.
that,
yeah.
Pleasing him.
Well, every child is, I mean,
yes.
You know.
Now, that is not the same way that my brother and sister approached communication, even
wow.
with my father or my mother. It just happened that was the way that seemed most natural to me.
Yeah, you had it.
I had it, mm-hmm. and I didn't realize then that it was actually an art form.
Yes, right.
I just...
You didn't know it was special.
It satisfied something for me.
Right.
And allowed me, it helped me to figure out the gray areas in my head, the cogweb kind of places, And if I put it down and could read it to myself and could, you know, make some sense of it, then I felt a little more confident when I had to leave my space.
Yes. Are you? Where are you in the birth order?
I'm the middle child.
You're the middle child.
Yes. Okay. And so, and that was a strange place to be, because you get responsibilities that you don't think are even yours. You end up being, and in my case, it was, I had an older sister, just, you know, a year or two, and a younger brother. So all the time I was having to divide myself between how to be a protector for those two people.
Yes, because you were the oldest boy. Right, because you were the
oldest
boy.
Oldest boy and the first.
Yes, exactly.
And so...
So she, it wasn't her job, the older sister. It went to the middle child who was the first boy.
Exactly.
Ah, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, and...
Well, this is... And it's tough.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. But it, you know, at the same time, for me, and I was not, you know, I don't know how, whether I should use the word normal or not, but... I was interested deeply in, you know, all the things that people take for granted, like, you know, just being wondrous about what happens to a seed.
Wow.
Or I can remember very early being curious about shades of color. And realizing that red is not just red.
Wow.
Or, you know, and so that became fascinating to me, which helped me to start understanding imagery and being able to be precise in what I saw as opposed to, you know, just calling something blue when it is not just blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you start to getting, you know, deeper and deeper into hues, you start to realizing there's a whole world there of expression.
Do you have any idea where this came from?
You know, at this point in life, I've come to believe that we come with it.
With it.
We come into the world
right.
with it. And I do believe... in a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that we are all given tools. It is whether we recognize or at what level we recognize those
and
tools.
Whether we're able to use them.
And whether they're useful to us. And sometimes, believe it or not, we come with it richly. And human circumstances many times will douse that fire out so early. And so then you come across these young, brilliant minds who have not been exposed to their greatness.
Yes.
Because they've had to deal with the putrid world's view.
Yeah. There are all kinds of ways in which we can be discouraged from being ourselves.
Absolutely. And that's why I say that many times, you know, young people, when you have the wonderful opportunity to work with them, you recognize that much of the time they hold back because they're afraid and they don't know that it's okay because they've come out of environments that just stumped that growth.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, just the opportunity to be creative was not there when they could have been at three.
Yes, I know.
But the circumstances
didn't allow. No, I know. You're preaching to the choir
yes.
here.
Yes.
So you had, it seems to me, several gifts that you've already described.
Mm-hmm.
The gift to see deeply into those things which people only see the surface of,
mm-hmm.
and an interest in a fascination with words for their own sake,
yes.
and the ability to express what you would be thinking or feeling or dealing with in those words. This all comes with the territory of being you.
Yes.
And were you encouraged, or at least not discouraged?
Early on, I used all of it as refuge.
Yes.
And so therefore, there was not this great encouragement from family or friends. In school, I had wonderful teachers who were very encouraging. And
well,
at
least at home, since you were keeping this a secret, you weren't discouraged.
I was not discouraged, and I came up in a time and a community where parents and teachers were coexisting. Even down the street, a teacher might live. So they talked. And those teachers would talk about you.
Yes.
And your parents
would listen.
Sometimes they would listen, and they would know things about you that they didn't necessarily entertain, but they knew it. And
right.
so if someone else were to take the time, they would allow that to happen.
Right, 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 right. So what did the teachers encourage in you?
My sister and I danced at an early age, and I just, I don't know, I believe I came out of the womb dancing. So, at a very early age, we totally enjoyed moving.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister, at that time, it was not fashionable for boys to take ballet.
No.
So my sister would go to ballet class, then she would come home after ballet class, and then we would get in the backyard and have class again. So,
boy, you were lucky.
We danced together, and we were a team, and we danced with a band, and we would dance at weddings. We were 7, 8, 9, 10
mm-hmm.
years old. By 10, we had done all of
that. Yeah, you had it down, right?
Yes.
Right.
But we were kids, really young, but everybody loved, so we got invited to everybody's wedding, and we would dance at their weddings and all that kind of stuff.
You were an act.
At an early age.
Right.
So being in front of people was not an issue.
No, you liked it.
I loved it.
Yeah, that's right.
Loved it.
Right, right.
Loved it, and it was always a wonderful feeling to know that someone was happy because of what you did.
Yes.
And the better you were at it, the happier they were. They didn't have to know you.
Right.
And that was wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, I've always lived for that opportunity to make someone smile, to make someone feel good about something they just experienced, that I had something
to do with.
To do with creating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So even in now in doing theater, whatever that project is, I learned very early on that there is no duplication in this life. Each effort is what it is.
Yes.
And you have the opportunity, being exposed to the material, to bring to it who you are, how you hear things, what you see out of your eyes. And so the music for any musical is what it is to the person who is working with it.
Yes.
It's,
and even
play.
And even were you to do it more than once, it wouldn't be the same.
It still wouldn't be the same.
Right.
And because you keep growing, you keep seeing things, you're exposed as you grow, your surroundings influence how you see things, current events, everything, has
and,
something
and
to do
And if you're
with
open, information's coming in all the
time. Yeah, and most full-time artists are open 24/7.
That's right.
So
that's right.
And you know, you learn when the it's just like with traffic. You learn the best times to go where you need to go.
Right.
In order to avoid the traffic. And so we have to be awake most of the time so we don't miss those opportunities.
That's great. Okay, so we have this extremely precocious, unusual, I don't want to say not normal, but quite unusual for a boy growing up when you did where you mm-hmm. were, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And he's lucky enough to be encouraged in school.
Yes.
And not to be discouraged.
Yes.
So, and he was smart enough, it seems to me, to have, I don't want to say hidden so much as protected
mm-hmm.
all those things.
Yes.
Right?
Somewhat. I'm not going to say that my childhood and all of that was just rosy.
No,
it was,
right.
You know, but being connected to that artistic energy allowed me to have a safe haven.
Yes. Inside yourself.
Inside myself, not
yeah.
out there.
No,
anywhere.
No.
And therefore, some things that probably would be devastating to others
right.
was information for creating.
It was grist for your mill.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I just approached it differently. Sometimes it made people say, you have grown up way too quickly, because things aren't affecting you the way they would affect
a child your
child
age.
My age.
Yeah.
And I just thought about a lot of things very early.
Okay, so do you know then at 10 that this is a career that you would want to dance or perform or make your living doing that? Do you know it's a career?
I don't know that I knew it in terms of the word career.
Yes.
I just knew that so far, nothing gets my attention.
Yes, right.
The way that does.
Right.
And
wow.
And so I think probably at that time I was just hoping that it would never end.
Yes, that you could
not
keep doing
that it was a career.
Right, but that it would just be, that it'd be in your life.
That it would just be in my life because it was so satisfying.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to make it be in my life.
No, clearly.
Or anything. I was just hoping, well, I hope this continues.
Right.
You know, you have math and science and
history
and English
right.
and all of that to right. accomplish, too.
Right.
And even that was not as interesting for me in terms of academic status.
You didn't care.
I didn't care about the grade.
Right.
I love history,
mm-hmm.
but I could only get into it based on the art. So if we were talking through art about history, I wanted to know everything that was going on now. If we had to just sit down and talk about
1902,
all the dates
right,
and
right,
what happened
right,
on
right,
those dates,
right.
And I want that surface to me.
Yeah, right.
So I had to struggle to just memorize.
Yeah, because that's a lot of what they want to teach you.
That's what they want to teach you.
Right.
And they don't want to talk about in depth.
No, because somebody stopped them in their childhood.
Right. And yes, and so I immediately started to feel that part of education was just about taking a test. And that was very boring to me.
I'll bet.
So
were you a good boy and tried to do it anyway, or did you rebel?
I was a good boy. I rebelled anyway. I was well-mannered, but
yeah, you rebelled courteously.
But I was a rebellious. Yes, I was very rebellious
yeah.
when it came to that, and I just a lot of times I felt where, you know, I know what 2 + 2 is.
Right.
I understand that. I'm not sure how many times I'm going to have to use that.
Right.
And so I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this, but I am going to figure out exactly what this particular worm looks like.
Right.
And be able to describe it.
Right. Right.
And have some purpose for it existing
in
the world.
Yeah.
That was all more interesting to me, and how I could use it to help someone understand something else.
Yeah.
So it was always imagery for me. I was always, and so history became imagery for me.
Right.
And I had one high school instructor who was a history instructor who was a veteran, and we were studying a World War II. And he was by far the most interesting instructor I had ever had. And I was thoroughly engrossed in the class. I did whatever he wanted us to do because he was descriptive. And he spoke viscerally about all of this. And he made it real for us. And it was everything that was in that book was lifted off of the page right before our eyes, and that was theater to
me. I was just going to say.
That was my first introduction to theater.
Yeah, right.
And I could see everything he was talking about without being there.
And so you could also see how compelling it was.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
So, you know, my introduction to these things, you know, is not just being in a fine arts program in a, you know,
really interesting to me about this is that you seem to have not only come in with all of these tools, but have come in with a kind of stubbornness about who you were.
I guess it was in my teens, when I was made to understand without a shadow of a doubt, and my mentor, Margaret Danner, who was one of the top 10 African-American poets in the country. And I just was blessed to have been in her life at the time. I can tell you about how all that happened. It was really funny, but anyway.
No, do tell.
She told me, made it very clear to me, that what you need to understand about yourself and this life is that the most important thing for you to fight for is your individuality. Nothing else is going to matter because no one can duplicate that.
Wow. You were a lucky boy.
That's what I got, and I got it early enough to realize that inside yourself is the best that there can be, because there is no duplication of that.
Right.
So, and you have to respect the fact that that exists in everyone else.
Right, right. But that, not only that, but that you have the right to protect that.
Oh, absolutely.
That you don't squander it.
No.
Right.
No, absolutely.
You were a lucky boy.
You create, and I was lucky also to be mentored by someone who demanded that you understand that you set your standards. No one sets standards for you.
That's great.
And so that individuality must come with a standard.
Yes, with the responsibility.
Responsibility of being individual.
Yes, yes, of living up to it.
You've got to live up to it, and you've got to protect it.
Right.
At all times.
Wow.
So,
I know lots of people who don't know that.
Well, I do too. So, if you ask me, what do you know for sure? That's what I know for sure.
Right.
And it has informed every second of my life since.
My God. Well, I should say, The Lin Show
mm-hmm.
is about being who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
I, for the first few minutes of the show, I talk about how, unfortunately, so many of us are forced to leave behind mm-hmm. essential aspects mm-hmm. of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art is because when you listen to them, you can hear mm-hmm. what it sounds like to be who
of
you
course.
Really are.
Of course.
And I have rarely had anybody come on and speak to this in exactly the same way. I'm so happy. You know, I won't have to say a word.
Well, I'm pleased at that. I'm glad that, that you know. I can make that contribution.
Oh, sure. My God.
Yes.
You know, it's because I'm a psychotherapist.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
So I spend my life essentially trying to help people. Essentially what you were talking about, you know, recover what they were forced to lose.
To lose, right. That's, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And I don't know what your experience of it is, but mm-hmm. mine is that when you have sacrificed a piece of yourself,
mm-hmm.
there was a really good reason.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't jettison this without a really good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you attempt to recover it, the reason comes back with it.
Yes.
So it's not a simple case of, oh, I see, I left my
yes,
capacity
right.
to behind and now I'm going to recover it.
No.
No. No. So do you see that when you work with children as well? Or
I do. And what I have come to know about that is that you have to go with them.
Yes. Wherever they are.
You have to take that trip back and revisit that with them. And you have to help them to understand that it is the past.
Yes.
And it is okay. It informs the future, but it is not the future.
Yes.
And so you can use it. Everything, every moment you have lived, good, bad, or indifferent, is good. It's oil for your canvas.
Yes. Yes.
Use it. It has a color. It has a tone, it has a weight,
yes.
all of that. And it is not negative.
No, and that's so important, I think. Because as long as you think of it as negative, you can't use it.
You can't use it. And as an artist, you must realize that you create so that others have a path to walk.
Yes.
Without, you know, you can take someone through something in an evening of theater and their world opens up to them.
Yes, because they see themselves.
They see themselves, and that is the most important thing about doing theater.
Yeah.
Is that you allow it to be a living stage, not something that is staged, and every moment you are together. See, I don't think that actors and audience are separate.
No.
You are interacting. Your energies are interacting when you're in the same room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, what is your responsibility to the rest of your cohorts in the room? They are part of what you're doing. They're not separate from what you're doing.
Right.
So, you need to be as clear and articulate as possible in order for them to understand and trust you on this journey. And all you're doing is taking them on a journey. And they will go with you if they trust you.
Yeah.
So that's the responsibility to me of the actor, to establish trust with their audience so that they feel when you sing a note and that note just fills the room, everybody should feel the same way you feel delivering it. Because, and even though they may never sing that note,
no,
they will know what that note can do. And so all you have to have is a memory of the note, hearing it, and it will make that moment happen
again.
For you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
So that's what you have to work for as an actor.
Yeah, it's truth, isn't it? It's honesty.
Pure pure, unadulterated truth,
right.
No matter what it is.
Right.
And when, you know, you get people who are kind of sheepish about certain material or whatever, whether an audience is going to be accepting of it. And my answer always is that an audience will always, without a doubt, accept the truth. They
have to like it.
They may not like it.
Right.
But they're not mad with you for telling the truth.
Right.
And they will not hold you accountable for telling the truth. Now, they will hold you accountable for untruths or half-truths.
Yes.
Because that is not what they can use in their everyday life.
Yeah.
Truth always.
Well, this is the first time you've said anything which I'm not sure I agree with. Because I'm thinking that a person who has not explored a particular thing in their life,
mm-hmm.
who is confronted on stage
mm-hmm.
with that truth,
mm-hmm.
may not be able to tolerate it.
Maybe not in that moment.
Oh, okay. No, right.
That's not right.
That's okay.
We can't. We are not in charge of any of that.
No, that's right. That's right. I got it. Okay, good.
Okay.
All right. I got it.
Yeah. We just have to be truthful.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that there's any reason that one wouldn't be truthful
mm-hmm,
on stage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just that sometimes the very truth is too painful for some people to tolerate.
I understand, but you see, I don't believe that it is the truth that is painful. I believe it is the lie they've been told,
or the wall
they have built.
Well, there, you and I agree right there.
Yes.
Right. Or the lie they're telling themselves.
That's basically what I'm saying.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you are confronted in theater, in the same room, with the truth.
With the truth. It's true.
See, you can sit it on the train and read it all day.
Yeah, no.
And still keep in your head what you want to believe.
That's right.
But when you are confronted in the room and it is living in your face.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Many times you make a decision right there. Well, I may not know what to do. But something has happened. Has happened,
right.
And something must be done.
Right. Okay, so I have you at 10 or 13 or something. So
mm-hmm.
what did you then do? I mean, how did you go from there to...
I kind of struggled through my teenage years.
I bet you did.
Because I was seeing the world differently from most of my peers.
And the adults in your life.
And the majority of the adults in my life. And in fact, to some degree, the adults kind of thought, well, he's just a little strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And so he's in his room, let him go in his room.
Right.
Or, yes.
Oh, right.
I could easily leave the house and just walk mm-hmm. for hours because I was so interested in every little inch I saw and was trying to remember it all so that whenever I had to articulate it,
I would have it. Right.
I was watching people as a child, not because I wanted to be like them. I just wanted to remember that they exist.
My God.
So that someday this thing that I know is going to happen, I'm going to be able to create all of these things again somehow.
So interesting. I mean, you're collecting this against something you don't know what it is.
Right. And it was all considered an odd behavior.
I'll bet it was.
And I couldn't explain then that is what artists go through.
Right.
Visual artists in particular.
Right.
And I'm a visual artist. Mm-hmm. Even though I have painted and everything, I don't think of myself as a painter in that way, but I am a painter.
Yes, right.
And I don't think of myself as a musician playing an instrument, but I'm a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have an ear that is like a musician. And I know what I need to hear in order to say what I need to say. Not because it's pretty to anyone.
Yes, no, right.
Because I use sound to paint. I use everything to paint.
Yes.
And
you're making a canvas.
I'm making my own canvas.
Right.
And all of the images that I need for to be in that painting will be there to say what I need to say.
Yeah, so. I got it. Okay, so now you're this odd emerging being,
mm-hmm.
And you don't know that there's a work out there that can use what you are addicted to doing.
Yeah, I didn't know until I began going to the theater.
When was that?
And I was 6th grade, I'm going to say. I
12, 13.
Yeah. I first remember my first live performance,
mm-hmm.
was a trip that my class, we were graduating from the 6th grade going into middle school.
Mm-hmm.
So our graduation trip was to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to go to the Christmas pageant that was it Christmas or Easter? Easter pageant.
Radio City?
Radio City with the Rockettes.
Yes, yes.
And so
oh my God.
Was fantastic. And we were, and I didn't realize how major it was, but we were invited to the premiere of Bye Bye Birdie.
Oh, my goodness.
So Dick Van Dyke was there, and all these people who were in the movie,
right?
Bye Bye Birdie, were there for the for the opening,
yeah.
And they came back. We were in a like you have a green room,
right?
They actually put us in the green room, and these people came in. I didn't know that Dick Van Dyke was a star. I didn't know any of these people
right.
were stars. It was only way later that I came to realize that I had met all of
them. Right.
Anyway. That was my first introduction, and it was just incredible.
It was mind-blowing.
Yes, it was. But the thing that was most interesting to me about that whole trip was being on the street in the morning, going to breakfast with my class, and we ate at the Kellogg Building or something, and they gave us Kellogg cereal or whatever. It was their headquarters or whatever. But on the way, we passed all of these people being literally shoveled up and put in a truck.
What?
And I was so disturbed that by the time we got to where we were supposed to be having fun, I was petrified. Just, I couldn't believe what I had seen. I've never been able to forget it all of these years.
I don't understand. Why was it happening? Do you know?
Well, I was told that every morning they clean the street of people who have slept there, died there, whatever. It was the most frightening thing. So, and I literally, a truck that was slowly going, and they would be taking people out of these hallways or whatever, and some people were on the street. Some of them were dead.
Unbelievable.
Well, as I said, this is a long interview, which I did not want to cut. So I'm ending here on this, which almost feels like a cliffhanger. And I will start next week's interview with this. So you'll hear this little bit again, and then the rest of Harry's remarkable interview. But what I do want to say about this, I simply want to reiterate some of the things that you heard Harry say and some of the things that I always say. Although Harry said them in a different and very compelling way, as he quoted his mentor, Margaret Danner, when she said that the most important thing you have to fight for is your individuality, that is something no one can duplicate, and that what is inside you is the best and most important thing. And that other really important point, the point of setting your own standard. Well, you can't set your own standard. You can't fight for your individuality if you don't know that what is inside you is the best, that your individuality is unduplicatable and worth fighting for. And if, as Harry points out, and as I say every week, something about your childhood made you unable to recognize the significance of your individuality, your unduplicatability, if something happened to you in your early life that suggested to you that what was going on inside of you was not the best, in fact, maybe it was flawed, or ugly, or weak, or scary. Quite often, when a parent discourages a child, it is not from malice or anger or the desire to hurt. Sometimes, those qualities which they see in a child are precisely the ones which they had to hide. And so it triggers those feelings inside of them. And they have no way of accessing them. They have no way of understanding their significant individuality. And so they feel compelled, unconsciously, without intention, to shut this down in the emerging being that is their child. This, as I said, is not malicious. It's self-defensive. But the fact that it is self-defensive does not limit the fact or undo the fact that it is devastating to the emerging child. So, not very many of us are able to do what Harry Bryce could do. All of us, as Harry said and I believe, come into this life with skills and talents and abilities and capacities and possibilities. But few of us are able to protect that in the way that Harry Bryce did, to find ways to nurture that within ourselves, to refuge ourselves. That is so remarkable and unique, and I want to make this point very, very clearly. That it can be done, Harry demonstrates. And in that, it is beautiful and lovely to see. But if you didn't do that, if you came into this life with a desire to dance, maybe you came out of the womb dancing like Harry, but your religion didn't approve of dancing, or your parents were frightened by the exuberance that you exhibited when you were dancing, and they found ways to let you know that that wasn't okay. If you couldn't find a way to protect that special uniqueness of you, you are in the majority. Harry is in the minority. But if that happened to you, it's not too late to recover it. If you were listening to my interview with Benjamin Williamson, who came into life without an awareness of a passion that he had and didn't really begin to explore it or look at it or discover it until his teens. And it has evolved and evolved to the point where he has embraced it and knows it is his passion. And some of my other interviews are of people who were not able to recover those things which they had lost until much later in life. So please don't be discouraged. Please know that it is possible. You can meet somebody like Harry who works with children to help them develop it, or you can go into therapy with somebody like me, but please don't be discouraged. Okay, I am almost certainly running out of time here. So I want to say, as I said at the beginning of the show, if you want to talk to me about that, you want me to come and talk to your group or organization, you want to read my book, or even come into therapy with me, you can reach me at thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, and click on the tab for email, or look at all the stuff I have up there, or listen to the beginning interview with Harry again. And if you were intrigued by this, as I cannot imagine that you weren't, then the rest of the interview, the story of what he does with his life, is coming next week. So as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show, something that amused you or inspired you, or something you learned that you didn't know, anything that will bring you back next week, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten